Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page, North Hills Cardinal in Revival Mode. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. And the article runs horizontally across the top of the page. At the far end, there's a picture of a man wearing a suit and tie. The caption reads, John Cain confirms he's no longer involved in developing the Cardinal. Major changes to plans for the Cardinal at North Hills Retirement Community have begun to emerge as a new development team takes over for Cain Realty, Duke Raleigh Hospital, and other local partners. Healthcare REIT of Toledo, Ohio, an early investor in the proposed $150 million project, has taken control of the Cardinal site at North Hills and brought in a new partner, Kisco Senior Living of Carlsbad, California, to resuscitate it on a smaller scale. John Cain, chairman and CEO of Cain Realty Corporation and multifamily development firm Drucker & Falk, were the original developers of the continuing care retirement project, but they have ceded all control of the six-acre site between Six Forks Road and St. Albans Drive. Neither Cain nor Drucker & Falk have any ongoing interest in the project, Cain confirms, but he declined to comment further. Cain halted all construction plans for the 204-unit project in fall 2010 after facing repeated regulatory delays and a slumping housing market. Before shutting down, the project had signed commitments and received deposits from more than 100 future tenants who were willing to pay entrance fees that would have ranged from $367,000 to more than $1 million once the building opened. North Carolina Department of Insurance spokeswoman Carrie Hall says all of the tenant deposits have been returned by the Cardinal. DOI approval is required for any business offering continuing care in North Carolina, but Hall says the department has seen no new application for the Cardinal. New plans for the Cardinal would replace the for-sale unit model with Kisco's finance model based on monthly rental fees. At Kisco's Magnolia Glen community in Raleigh, for example, the rental rate for an independent living apartment starts at $2,170 per month. That community opened in 2002. Neither Kisco nor Healthcare REIT have filed new building plans with the city, but sources close to the project say new site renderings show a four-story building instead of the previously envisioned eight-story building. It will offer a mix of independent living, assisted living, and skilled nursing options. Also missing from the new plan is Duke Raleigh Hospital's 20,000-square-foot wellness center that had been proposed for the Cardinal in 2009. Kisco's plan would still include an indoor swimming pool and other amenities, but its facilities would be open only to Cardinal residents, whereas Duke Raleigh's facility would have been open to a broader membership. Duke Raleigh spokeswoman Carla Hollis says hospital officials have had no conversations with Kisco or with Cain's development team since the project was halted. We were involved in its former state when it was going to have owned residences, but when that came to a halt, it wasn't really something that fit with our vision, she says. Hollis says the hospital still wants to expand its wellness facility, which currently occupies about 7,500 square feet in one of the hospital campus's oldest buildings. We continue to explore options, but right now we've not made a decision where it will be located, she says. Neither officials from Kisco nor from Healthcare REIT returned calls for comment. Healthcare REIT, a public company whose stock trades on the New York Stock Exchange, invested $10 million in the Cardinal Project in 2008, according to company filings, and it had previously earmarked $39 million for construction in 2010 before the project was halted. The Real Estate Investment Trust currently has more than $150 million in new senior housing development projects in its construction pipeline, but that pipeline does not yet list the Cardinal. Kisco Senior Living operates 19 senior housing communities across the country, including Magnolia Glen and Abbotswood at Stonehenge in North Raleigh and Woodland Terrace in Cary. And we move down the page from that article to our next article on the front page, has a black border around it, Inside that border, the top third is a picture of a man in suit and tie sitting at his desk in front of his computer. The caption reads, CQ's Jim Blaine wanted members to know an important data point for the credit union he runs. And then under that, there's the article in bold black lettering. Blaine sets off brouhaha. Feds angry with CQ, state regulators over release. And then next to the where the article starts, the article begins on the right side, but on the left side, there's a rendering, a picture of a large building with SECU, CQ, at the top. And the building is lit up. It's a large rectangle with a triangle, kind of a triangle at the top. The caption reads, rendering of SECU's CQ's new headquarters now rising in downtown Raleigh. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a dateline of Raleigh. Federal regulators are smoldering over a late 2011 decision by the North Carolina State Employees Credit Union and its state regulator, the North Carolina Credit Union Division, to release CQ's secret financial stability rating in an act of transparency. Friction over the move, in fact, has sparked a six-month controversy in which at one point the National Credit Union Administration, NCUA, dispatched an army of examiners to North Carolina to go over the books of all state-chartered credit unions. The industry has been left riled up, feeling squeezed, and looking for ways, including switching from state to federal charters, to avoid a repetition. The origins of the dispute go back to October, when SECU-CQ, the nation's second-largest credit union, with $23 billion in assets, posted its CAMEL score, that's C-A-M-E-L score, solid at number 2 on its website. David Marquis, executive director of NCUA, the federal agency that insures the deposits of both state and federally chartered credit unions across the country, was not amused. CAMEL is a widely used financial rating system that looks at an institution's capital adequacy, management, and other factors, assigning a score of 1 through 5. A score of 1 means excellent, with a 5 indicating serious if not terminal weaknesses. Historically, the CAMEL results for banks and credit unions have been kept secret. But CQ President James Blaine believed the 1.7 million members depositing money with the credit union deserve to know whether it is financially sound. So he sought permission to make the CAMEL disclosure from the North Carolina Credit Union Division, a part of the North Carolina Department of Commerce that regulates North Carolina's 51 state-chartered credit unions and its director, Jerry Jay. After getting the go-ahead from Jay, CQ posted the score, issued a press release for the occasion, and waited for a response from its 1.7 million members. The response we got was zero, says Blaine. CQ members may not have been moved, but Marquis was. Reacting to events in North Carolina, the NCUA chief ruled that CQ's CAMEL disclosure was a violation of federal policy and of, quote, the trust of confidentiality, unquote, of CAMEL ratings. But the matter didn't stop there. Since the North Carolina Credit Union Division had sanctioned the release, NCUA decided to stop conducting joint exams with state regulators and to not accept the results of state-level financial examinations of North Carolina credit unions. That was when NCUA ordered federal examiners into the state to conduct separate annual audits. That move left dozens of North Carolina credit unions facing the time and expense of two financial exams, one state, one federal. They spent large amounts of time and money to examine what they admit are safe and sound credit unions, says Jay. In repeated letters, the federal agency has demanded that state regulators abandon their CAMEL release policy and ensure that CQ takes down the number 2 rating it has posted on its website. Our position has not changed, says NCUA spokesman John Zimmerman, adding that without those conditions being met, the dual exams will continue, though we know it's a burden on the credit unions. He declined to answer whether the dual audit policy could be interpreted as a reprisal by NCUA for CQ's CAMEL release. From the start, Jay has limited the release of CAMEL information only to credit unions managing more than $10 billion in assets. CQ is the only North Carolina organization fitting that description. Jay says she has repeatedly invited NCUA representatives to meetings to discuss the controversy, but none have accepted. Meanwhile, nervousness prevails throughout the state's credit union industry, which wants the dual exams to end. In a recent poll of 39 state-chartered credit unions taken by the industry's trade association, 30% said they'd consider reorganizing under federal charters to avoid facing dual audits. Dual examinations have added a layer of uncertainty and complexity in an already challenging regulatory environment and further strained the resources of especially smaller credit unions, says John Raidbaugh, president of the North Carolina Credit Union League, the group that formed the poll, Left unresolved, this situation will undermine or quite possibly threaten the dual charter structure that has successfully served North Carolina credit unions for many years, he says. And we have one more article on the front page. This article runs vertically along the right side of the page. The headline, RDU shipments continue to dip. And this article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Morrisville. And underneath the article, there are two small pictures. One is the outside of some FedEx cargo trucks. And then under that, there's a wing of a UPS airplane. The caption reads, FedEx and UPS rule the cargo roost at RDU. High fuel prices and cutthroat competition in the United States have led two large international carriers to pull out of Raleigh-Durham International Airport as cargo shipped through the airport continues to decline. Logistics company DB Schenker shut down its RDU operations late last year and vacated its space at the airport's cargo facility in January. That came after global shipper DHL began to cut back domestic shipping in 2008, quit flying at RDU in late 2009, and bought out its lease for airport space last spring, RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin confirms. Total cargo values at RDU have zagged downward since 2008 and fell in 2011 by nearly 6%, according to airport statistics. The airport is budgeting about $140,000 less in revenue from landing fees on cargo carriers in its coming fiscal year, which begins April 1. The loss of Schenker accounts for about $128,000 of that, but the two giants, FedEx and United Parcel Service, are also expected to contribute slightly less than in the fiscal year now ending, reflecting an expectation that they'll be flying smaller planes or landing less often. Taken together, it means about $300,000 less operating revenue in the coming fiscal year, including landing fees and rental of space. The airport authority expects total revenue to grow, however, thanks to increased rates for parking and growing sales by restaurants and other concessionaires. While both FedEx and UPS have continued to report ever higher global revenue and profit, their domestic business is recovering less quickly from the recession. UPS's domestic package revenue edged back to previous highs only last year, and FedEx's has yet to do so, according to the company's security filings. Meanwhile, industry consultant Bob Mann says ferocious competition from the two giants didn't leave enough business for DHL when it launched into domestic delivery in 2005. It's just hideously expensive to break through two very entrenched competitors, Mann says. DB Schenker's move had more to do with escalating fuel prices and the lingering effects of the Great Recession, CEO Heiner Mermann said last summer in announcing the company's plans to wind down its domestic transportation business. Passenger airlines have described a similar dynamic in their decision to raise fares and cut capacity. Such moves have held down RDU's passenger traffic in recent months and prompted airport managers to budget for a decline of about 1% in traffic in the coming fiscal year. Schenker Marketing Director Raquel Garcia says her company's move is allowing it to focus on its international logistics business, for example, delivering factory equipment from a company's U.S. subsidiary in Cary to its European subsidiary in Munich. The company now uses forwarding agents in Durham and elsewhere to route its North Carolina business through Charlotte Douglas International Airport, Garcia says. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Home for Peace President Fetches $1.3 Million for College. And right under that, there's a picture directly from the front of the home. The caption reads, Former William Peace President's Home in Raleigh. William Peace University has sold the 5,167-square-foot brick house on Williamsboro Court near Raleigh's North Hills that served as home to its president since the late 1970s. Capstrat executive John Peterson and his wife Martha paid $1.3 million for the home, well below the tax value of $1.7 million, according to Wake County records. The university's board of trustees intends to buy or build a home near the school's downtown Raleigh campus for President Deborah Townsley, who is living in a private residence in West Raleigh. The board decided in January that the residence should be in downtown Raleigh near the campus to create more meeting and entertainment space for students, faculty, alumni, and staff. SAS software is used for endless commercial and medical applications and NCAA brackets. SAS consultant Gary Kokin says some NC State University professors have used SAS software to predict with 94% accuracy which teams will make the men's hoops tournament, and they've been doing it for more than 10 years. The software is so flexible, Kokin says. This year, it correctly predicted 36 out of the 37 bids. The profs don't pick tournament winners. If they did, the Wolfpack surely would still be playing. More than 400 people in the movie and television industries are using an iPhone app to check out sites in North Carolina for filming. The mobile software was developed by Red Scout Incorporated of Charlotte and uses photographs provided by the North Carolina Film Office. Aaron Syrett, who heads the office, says the collection includes tens of thousands of photos shot at several thousand locations. The free app is aimed at promoting the state as a location for filming and facilitating producers' decisions to film here. Syrett and colleagues introduced the app in late January in Park City, Utah, at the Sundance Film Festival. It expects downloads of the app to accelerate when it launches a marketing campaign in the next few months. Chapel Hill-based Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina has been recognized as one of the world's most ethical companies by Ethisphere Institute, a group that promotes best practices in business ethics. Also on the list are General Electric, Starbucks, Target, Cisco Systems, and Whole Foods. Only one American bank, Evansville, Indiana-based Old National Bank, made the list. Factors considered are company codes of conduct and track records involving litigation and regulatory infractions. Bill Atkinson, never one at a loss for words, will send graduates of Campbell University's College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences into the world with some of his thoughts. The WakeMed Health and Hospital CEO will deliver the graduation address at 3 p.m. on May 11 at the John W. Pope Jr. Convocation Center in Buies Creek. Fans of former U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice will get a chance to hear her speak in the Triangle. Rice will speak in Duke University's Page Auditorium on April 10. From 2005 to 2009, Rice served as the nation's 66th Secretary of State. She was the second woman and first African-American woman to hold the post. The event is free and open to the public, but tickets are required. Beginning April 4, tickets will be available for pickup at the Duke box office or online at www.tickets.duke.edu. Raleigh attorney Andrea Karska Shepherd has been appointed to a group that advises the International Olympic Committee on policies relating to women in sports. The Women and Sport Commission advises the IOC's executive board. Karska Shepherd is an international business and trade attorney in Smithmore Leatherwood's Raleigh office, who worked at a sports journalist before entering law school at McGill University in Montreal. She speaks six languages. You know about the 40 under 40 crew, but these guys cut that in half. Three Raleigh brothers who love fly fishing, Tyler Strickland, age 21, Brandon Strickland, age 18, and Justin Strickland, age 16, have started a business to sell fishing apparel. They came up with the idea, designed the logos, developed a business plan, set up manufacturing and distribution, and designed the website all on their own, says their dad, Mark Strickland. The business is aptly named Strick Lines and will sell Hooked Life and Cast Life apparel structured for e-commerce, wholesale, and retail sales. Highwoods Properties in Raleigh has added a new C-level position to its roster of senior officers, even though the company has made no formal announcement of the new hire. Ted Klink, who most recently served as principal and chief investment officer of Goddard Investment Group in Atlanta, joined Highwoods in March as the company's first chief investment officer, according to his bio posted last week on Highwoods' website. Prior to joining Goddard, Klink spent 16 years with Morgan Stanley Real Estate and its predecessor companies, and he has overseen the closing of more than $15 billion worth of transactions over the past 10 years. The North Carolina Science Festival, a 16-day series of events showcasing science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, STEM, will be April 13 through 29 and is expected to attract more than 150,000 participants to events spread across the state. The festival began in 2010 as an initiative of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's Morehead Planetarium and Science Center, which continues to produce events and administer the festival. The website is ncsciencefestival.org. Among sponsors is Time Warner Cable, which is contributing $100,000 in cash and in-kind support, and News 14 Carolina, a Time Warner Cable holding, which is giving $25,000. The money is coming from Connect a Million Minds, Time Warner Cable's five-year, $100 million philanthropic initiative to connect youth to ideas, people, and opportunities that will inspire them to pursue education and careers in STEM. Biz can tune in to that. Williams Mullen Law Firm has hired its first chief information officer, a move that the firm says will help it acclimate to clients' shifting demands, changes in the legal services industry, and recent changes in its own business model. CIO Dana Isakoff is based in the firm's Richmond headquarters. Williams Mullen has about 300 attorneys. Isakoff's hire goes along with her firm's newly adopted project management approach. United Healthcare, which is steadily clawing its way into the North Carolina market, is offering a way for employees to earn more than $1,000 by participating in wellness programs and achieving recommended health levels. Called Simply Engaged Plus, healthy benchmarks are total cholesterol of less than 200 milligrams, blood pressure of less than or equal to 130 over 80, body mass index of less than or equal to 25, no nicotine use. Participants get $250 for meeting each benchmark. Raleigh marketing and design firm Red House Group has launched two websites to promote job growth in the Triangle in partnership with regional business groups. It has partnered with the Orange County Economic Development Group to start www.growinorangenc.com to promote businesses and cultural activities in Orange County. The second site, www.triangleworksource.com, is designed to help businesses find recruiting and training resources in the 13-county Triangle region. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Chris Bagley, Jason DeBrun, and Lauren Onsorge. And now we return to our full-length stories in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to, the headline, Acquisition Could Lead to Forbo Shutdown. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a dateline of Morrisville. The 65 people who work at what used to be Forbo Adhesives on Davis Drive in Morrisville may not have jobs after July. That's when the new owner, St. Paul, Minnesota-based H.B. Fuller, plans to make decisions about facility closures worldwide. H.B. Fuller on March 5 closed on the $395 million purchase of the global industrial adhesives business of Switzerland-based Forbo Group, consummating an agreement that had been reached in December. H.B. Fuller Corporate Relations Director Kimberly Sinclair says the local facility could close but offers few concrete details. As is true in most acquisitions of this size and nature, there is overlap between the two organizations, which will lead to some facility closure, she says. Sinclair insists H.B. Fuller has not made any final decisions and is, quote, not in a position today to provide specifics on impacts to individual locations, unquote. No decisions on closure, she says, will be made before July, but she hesitates to say Triangle employees' jobs are safe in the meantime. This is business, and you never know day to day what might happen, but our time frame is that we're looking at our organizational design and geographic footprint with the intent to make all decisions on a global basis by mid-July, she says, adding that displaced employees may be able to transfer to other H.B. Fuller sites. While most facilities acquired in the purchase are manufacturing sites, the Triangle location is an office facility, she says, providing finance, administration, customer service support for the company. Any restructuring will be about taking the best of both companies, she says. The adhesives business represented about 80% by revenue of the Forbo Bonding Systems division of Forbo Group at the time of the sale and generated approximately $580 million in revenue for the fiscal year ending December 31, 2011. The adhesives division operated 17 manufacturing facilities in 10 countries and employed more than 1,100 people globally, according to a press release announcing the acquisition. The sale did not include the building and construction adhesives business of Forbo Group. Sinclair says the Morrisville facility is one of 7 U.S. locations acquired in the purchase. The acquisition strengthens H.B. Fuller and positions us to capitalize on growth opportunities in key geographies and markets such as packaging and durable assembly, H.B. Fuller CEO Jim Owen said in a statement. He hinted at the time of the acquisition that there would be restructuring. We will leverage our combined assets, people, products, processes, systems, and knowledge to offer customers a superior choice in adhesives, Owen said. On its website, H.B. Fuller touts itself as being a leading global industrial adhesives provider for 125 years. Since 2009, the company has purchased 4 adhesive makers. Repeated attempts to contact Owens and local H.B. Fuller supervisor, Vice President Jack Chambers, a former president at Forbo Adhesives, were unsuccessful. Forbo Group spokesperson Karen Marty referred all questions to H.B. Fuller. And as we move down the page, there's another article with a black border around it. Inside that border, the top third has a picture of a man standing in a room with a yellow wall with a poster on the wall that says North Carolina Health Information Exchange. He's wearing a tie, no jacket. The caption reads, Jeff Miller heads up the North Carolina Health Information Exchange. Then under that, there's a bold black headline and a first article that starts in the second third of this area. The headline, Building a Network, State Begins Linking Medical Records. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Raleigh. We'll read this first, and then there's another article that begins underneath it. We'll read that next. Thanks to a new partnership, private practice physicians can gain access to statewide medical data and qualify for federal incentives for as little as $100 a year. Community Care of North Carolina, which has established networks of health services for some 1.3 million Medicaid-eligible patients in the state, has become the first qualified partner with the North Carolina Health Information Exchange, a group that will help electronically connect physicians with medical records. This will allow physician practices, hospitals, labs, and other healthcare providers to connect to a statewide network of electronic medical records through CCNC. Getting actionable data into the hands of clinicians in order to improve care is a core part of CCNC's mission, says Dr. Alan Dobson, CCNC president and CEO. Linking North Carolina providers to the North Carolina HIE's Health Information Exchange is an important first step toward more intelligent data use across North Carolina's healthcare system, he says. As close followers of health reform know, the federal government offers incentives to practices to establish an electronic medical record, EMR. The next step is to connect those records across the state so doctors and other providers can have access to them. Many healthcare providers worry about the costs involved. Access offered through CCNC, which has satisfied the federal government's meaningful use stipulations required for incentive payments, costs $100 to $175 per physician per year. For hospitals, the cost will be $1 per year for every $10,000 in net patient revenue. For scale, WakeMed Health and Hospitals recorded nearly $1 billion of patient revenue in 2011. UNC Healthcare, which includes its subsidiary Rex Healthcare, reported nearly $2 billion. To be sure, a practice that does not have an EMR would incur startup costs, but Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina and Allscripts have formed a joint venture to help there as well. That $23 million partnership offers to cover 85% of the software and setup costs for 600 physicians and eligible independent practices, and 100% of the cost for eligible free clinics. That program is called the North Carolina Program to Advance Technology for Health, NCPATH, and practices that use it will join NCHIE through CCNC. Healthcare providers cannot connect directly to NCHIE. They must instead go through a qualified organization. It would be too cumbersome for NCHIE to market directly to the state's 24,000 physicians, says NCHIE CEO Jeff Miller, so partnerships will be formed with what are called qualified organizations to bite off smaller chunks. CCNC is the first, but NCHIE hopes to sign on many more, Miller says. Through a qualified organization, QO, though a qualified organization, QO, may not turn any practice away, it is more likely that physicians will join with qualified organizations in which they share more in common. A radiology practice, for example, would find more benefit from joining a QO with other imaging specialists. Because CCNC works mostly with primary care physicians, it would likely sign on mostly those kinds of doctors. NCHIE is North Carolina's designated entity by the federal government and has received $14 million in grants to get started. However, it is not the only way for physicians to connect to the statewide medical information exchange network. The North Carolina Health Exchange, NCHEX, for example, is sponsored by the North Carolina Hospital Association. The difference between the systems comes down to software and user interface. The North Carolina Medical Society has worked closely with NCHIE and throws its full support behind the partnership with CCNC, especially because it will help physician practices in rural areas affordably connect to the information exchange and qualify for federal incentives. And it should improve a doctor's ability to treat a patient. You've got better information at the point of care, says Melanie Phelps, executive director of the North Carolina Medical Society Foundation, which helps practices implement electronic health records through loans or technical assistance. All docs want more information, not less, she says. Now, in the same box that article started in, the bottom third has a yellow background, and another article begins there. The headline on this article, Access to Records Can Be Vital in Treatment. This article also written by Jason DeBrun. As in many walks of life, good information can make a big difference. In the case of medical records, that difference can be between life and death. To that end, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is working to establish electronic information networks filled with patient medical records that doctors can access. This would not only give immediate access to patient history in an emergency, say crucial information about a drug or allergy while treating a trauma patient after a car accident during a vacation away from home, but also reduced the number of redundant tests that helped drive overall costs higher. The information exchange networks would electronically connect participating physicians and hospitals so doctors everywhere could have quick and easy access to a patient's medical history, something that is sometimes sent via fax. Under the Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health, High Tech Act, HHS has the authority to promote health information technology such as the exchanges. It awards various Medicare and Medicaid incentives when healthcare providers achieve meaningful use, a buzzword that proves providers are capable of distributing and accessing medical records. As part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2010, HHS has awarded $548 million to help states begin developing exchange networks through the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. North Carolina received $13 million. Now, next to those articles, to the right, there's a separate article, also written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. But this article has the headline, Raleigh Doctor Claims Partners Stole Records. And underneath the article, there's a picture of a doctor standing in a file room, an old-style file room where they're actually paper files. The caption reads, Dr. E. Brooks Wilkins took action against former partners. A Raleigh physician contends that five doctors who worked for him stole patient information from his practice and improperly marketed a new practice they established to the most lucrative of those patients. Dr. E. Brooks Wilkins of E. Brooks Wilkins Family Medicine says a group of doctors who worked for him left to join WakeMed Health and Hospitals at the Falls Point Medical Group and stole a patient list that included names, addresses, phone numbers, visits, method of payment, and whether or not they were Medicare patients. The patient lists were a closely guarded secret, and individuals within the practice would have had no access to those lists outside for a few specific purposes, according to the complaint Wilkins filed in Wake County Superior Court. Wilkins alleges the physicians, Dr. Enam Rashid, Dr. Leslie Robinson, Dr. Michelle Casey, Dr. Monica Oe, and Dr. Rushad Shroff, targeted those patients to lure them away. In a Dear Neighbor letter, Wake Specialty Physicians, part of WakeMed, promotes the new Falls Point practice listing Drs. Casey, O.A., Rashid, and Robinson as members. Shroff now practices at Harps Mill Internal Medicine, part of Duke University Healthcare. The patient list has extreme value to the practice as it was the sole source of information concerning the customers of the practice, according to Wilkins' complaint. Further, the patient list provided the sole method of marketing to the patients within the practice and would also have great value to a competitor in that it may have provided not only the patient's contact information, but also how they paid, how many times they visit, and whether the patient has Medicare or private insurance, the lawsuit states. The week after the Dear Neighbor letter went out, Wilkins says he received between 30 and 50 calls per day about the letter, and as a result lost several patients, including many long-time patients. Wilkins claims misappropriation of trade secrets and unfair and deceptive trade practices against the other physicians and is seeking a court judgment for unspecified damages. Wilkins also filed complaints with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Office for Civil Rights, and the North Carolina Medical Board. Through WakeMed spokeswoman Kara Bolton, the hospital system, Wake Specialty Physicians and the doctors employed at Falls Point Medical Group declined comment. Shroff did not return a phone message left at his practice. Besides saying that, I stand by the allegations in the complaint, Wilkins declined comment. Per state law, complaints filed at the medical board are confidential, but spokeswoman Jean Fisher-Brinkley says if the board takes a public action, that action would be entered in the public record. Wilkins' attorney, Benjamin Overby, with the Vernon Law Firm in Burlington, did not return messages. Other healthcare attorneys, including members of the North Carolina Society of Healthcare Attorneys and the American Health Lawyers Association, did not return messages. And our next article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Research Triangle Park. The headline, Geolus Kraft's RTP 2.0 vision. Don't expect high-rise towers to begin sprouting in the center of Research Triangle Park anytime soon, but creative development that fosters startups and attracts young talent has become a top priority for the new leadership of RTP. Bob Giolis was hired in November as the new president and CEO of Research Triangle Foundation, and from day one, he says his board of directors had a mandate. They were looking for an action plan, he says. They had completed this master plan, but somebody needed to move it forward and make this happen. Specifics of the new master plan have not been disclosed publicly, even though work on the plan was completed in fall 2011. But Giolis notes that it does encourage more infill and mixed-use development in three or four designated zones within the park. Park officials already are in talks with several national real estate developer groups, including Hines of Houston, Texas, and Forest City Enterprises of Cleveland, Ohio, each of which have experience in guiding and financing big real estate projects. This partner, Giolis says, would be responsible for spearheading the first project under the new master plan guidelines, but what that project would look like or even where it will be located is still unknown. I'd like by the end of this year, we'll announce the project and the partner, he says. Any development partner in RTP would need to identify a property owner willing to cooperate because more than 90% of the 7,000 acres that make up RTP are owned or managed by the companies in the park. The real estate partner also would have to work with the foundation to resolve any zoning issues with Durham County or Wake County government. Neither Wake County manager David Cook nor Durham County manager Mike Ruffin have seen details of the master plan. I think it's exciting, but I don't know what it is yet, Cook says. Jim Captain, Raleigh site executive for Credit Suisse, says he hopes the plan will result in more common areas to include offerings such as restaurants and retail. That, he said, could cut down on vehicular traffic. The park is a beautiful setting, Captain says, but if we didn't have a cafeteria in our building, everybody would have to get in their car and drive outside the park to find something to eat. We're a bunch of individual businesses that don't have a lot of face time together. We need some common areas for people to mingle. Giolis says creation of more common areas is one of the key goals of the master plan. We're going to have to think about things differently, he says, acknowledging that the way companies interact with their employees and with neighboring companies has changed since the park was started more than 50 years ago. Younger employees are not as excited about this kind of environment, he said. That's what I'm thinking about. Data demand drives and challenges NetApp. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a Dateline of Research Triangle Park. Since opening its East Coast outpost in the Triangle in 1999, NetApp has grown steadily on the back of growing global demand for data storage services, but meeting that demand against stiff competition represents the company's biggest challenge. In each year of its operations at RTP, where it purchased buildings from Cisco Systems in 2004, NetApp has grown by about 200 employees, and 2012 is no exception. The company is preparing to occupy a fourth building in RTP while immediately hiring for 50 positions, a number expected to increase exponentially through the end of the calendar year. The reason? NetApp stores data, lots of data, and in RTP, it's doing so in a state-of-the-art three-year-old building that attracts businesses from across the country for tours. The facility is the first of its kind to net an Energy Star certification, says NetApp Director Mark Skiff. Growth, however, comes with its own challenges. Craig Hallam analyst Eric Martinuzzi warns of NetApp, the bigger you are, the harder it is being able to maintain a growth rate in an overall market that's growing maybe 12 to 15%, making sure you are the one that grows in the mid to high teens as opposed to single digits, says Martinuzzi. He notes that even as data storage needs increase, customers are shopping around for the best prices. That's why NetApp has to keep expanding its customer base as well as its technologies, says Martinuzzi, and so far it's been able to do it. Just the amount of storage people need, it's doubling every 18 to 24 months, he says. adding that NetApp has, quote, the right products at the right time, unquote. Additionally, last year's $480 million acquisition of LSI Storage Division and Genio helped arm NetApp with additional capacity. But plenty of competition remains. Massachusetts-based EMC and IBM, a partner with NetApp on some projects, both are on pace to increase their market shares. NetApp will have to keep innovating to keep up, a factor that NetApp Senior Vice President Rich Clifton says he's always thinking about. While NetApp has dabbled in several environments, with much of its focus on government agencies, it plans to expand significantly into the healthcare and financial sectors. We can't take growth for granted, Clifton says, and he embraces the idea of infinite data management capabilities without limits. Just imagine where we'll be, he says. For us, it's all about how do we help companies with the aggregation of that data, the analysis of that data, the retention and protection of that data in ways that make it a more valuable asset while at the same time reducing the cost every day of keeping it. It's an arms race to keep up, and one in which NetApp plans to stay an active player at all of its locations, including RTP. Investors are watching. NetApp shares are trading in the $46 range, midway between the company's 52-week high and low marks on strong volume. And our next article is also written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Durham. The headline, In This Durham Incubator, Good Ideas Are the Ticket. Gemma Touch started with a conversation about quick response codes, those squiggly black squares that can tell you with a touch of your smartphone the dimensions of that TV on the sales floor. We were talking about limitations, Brent Fagg says of the codes. Rather than suggest changes, they decided to come up with their own secret sauce, a near-field communication NFC device that allows devices to communicate with any type of printed material, expanding the QR possibilities. Doing beta testing since early January, the Gemma Touch crew members keep their day jobs as they bootstrap the company. But that could change soon. They're one of five companies currently incubating at Groundwork Labs, an office space and mentoring service for the super startup, a startup so conceptual and so early stage that other incubators and accelerators look the other way. Groundwork Executive Director John Austin says Groundwork, funded by the North Carolina Idea Foundation, fulfills the mission of North Carolina Idea to reward ideas, not just proven business models. Typically, more advanced startups get the funding or other support, he says, leaving ideas like Gemma Touch out of the loop. Groundwork, set up in the American Underground at the American Tobacco Campus, looks for one or two people that have an idea, he says, no prior funding necessary. Groundwork takes no equity or financial stake in the companies and offers no monetary incentives, just mentoring and space, putting small startups in better situations to compete for funding. Groundwork plans to cycle through about 15 startups every 6 months. The first crop moved in 30 days ago. Within the next 60 days, they'll have moved on. Austin says he's not negating the natural selection of early-stage funding struggles. He's providing opportunity. It's about the idea, an idea that can turn into a large business, he says. Austin knows from personal experience, an entrepreneur, he started Joystick, a video game accelerator, in February of 2010. Six of the seven Joystick incubated companies are still around, shipping games such as Labratt's Studios' December release, Muse for iPad. Groundwork startup Mint Markets' Ricky Sparrow says, the number of startups is irrelevant to a startup's success. If there are 10 startups or 100 startups, there is no reason they can't be big, great businesses, he says. I don't think of other startups as competition. Ted Zoller, director of the Center for Entrepreneurial Studies at UNC Chapel Hill, agrees. I would fully expect that as our region develops, we'll see more and more of these types of facilities come out of the woodwork, he says, adding that vibrant ecosystems such as those of Silicon Valley and Boston have spawned hundreds of incubators. As for Austin, he rejects any cynicism. It's about giving them a chance, he says. They could all make it. Accounting changes could brighten CRO bottom lines. This article written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Raleigh. Clinical research organizations could end up looking more consistently profitable when U.S. accounting standards are overhauled in the next few years, say certified public accountants. Under proposed rules, companies entering certain types of contracts for research or other work could decide at the outset when they will recognize the revenue from those contracts. The rules apply equally to companies in a wide range of industries, but CROs, which employ nearly 10,000 people in the research triangle, are expected to be particularly affected because of their business practices. The change should make financial planning easier and more predictable for many companies. It could also allow some to recognize some of the revenue sooner than they do now, accountants say. Both effects are important because they could allow contractors to present a stronger financial appearance to investors, bankers, and others who rely on their financial statements. A key change involves revenue associated with periodic milestone payments that companies get from customers when they accomplish certain goals defined in their contracts. Contractors now record revenue when they meet those goals. Under the new rules, the connection between the milestones and recording the revenue would be less direct as long as the contractor doesn't fall seriously behind. Dwayne Southern, an audit partner with Grant Thornton LLP in Raleigh, says one aim of the rules is to match revenue more evenly with the expenses that firms incur while earning it. That's because a company working under a contract will be allowed to break down the work into smaller tasks and record revenue for each task as it's completed, rather than waiting until it meets all the criteria for the actual payment, says Bruce Branson, an accounting professor at NC State University. The changes are part of an overhaul in generally accepted accounting principles known as GAAP, G-A-A-P, the accounting rules for all public and most private U.S. companies. No timeline has been set for implementing the changes, but they're not likely to take effect before 2015, says Chris Klimek, a spokeswoman for the government-designated group that maintains GAAP, the Financial Accounting Standards Board. And for our remaining minutes, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here's some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Business owners riled up over Chapel Hill cell phone ban. A new Chapel Hill measure that bans cell phone use while driving has ticked off some business owners. The ban, discussed in Chapel Hill Town Council chambers for the past 2 years, passed by a vote of 5-4 on Monday night. The ban includes Bluetooth devices and is classified as a secondary moving violation, meaning that it can't be the only reason a motorist is stopped by a law enforcement officer. The ban will cause problems for a company like Advantaclean, says owner Dave Cotton. It's important when a customer calls that we respond immediately, he says. How do I do that when I'm driving down Franklin Street? Where do I pull over? His South Point-based cleaning service, with 6 Triangle locations and about 20 employees, responds to emergency situations such as floods and fires. Without my phone, I'm out of business, he says. Toll Brothers CEO, best spring in 5 years. Are we finally seeing some national home builders get bullish on the housing industry? If you listen to Toll Brothers CEO Douglas Yearley, you may think the industry has turned the corner. Talking to CNBC on March 27, Yearley says Toll had the best spring in 5 years with orders up and home prices are beginning to inch up. Toll, which owns several communities in the Triangle area, including the Briar Creek and Hassentree subdivision, is one of the area's largest builders of luxury homes. Bank of America hit with downgrade. An analyst at Robert W. Baird has downgraded Bank of America stock from outperform to neutral. According to CNBC analyst David George, made the move because he fears the Charlotte-based bank's divestitures have cost it too much earnings power. George did raise his price target on the stock from $9 up to $10. Bank of America ranks 6th in the triangle with a deposit market share of 8%. Kel Landis joins UNC Board of Trustees. Kel Landis, former CEO of RBC Centura Bank, was named as the newest member of the Board of Trustees at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill on Monday. The UNC Chapel Hill alum joins the 13-member board, taking the seat of Eddie Smith, who resigned this fall. Now a partner with Plexus Capital, Landis was CEO of RBC Centura Bank from 2001 until his retirement in 2004, after serving as president of Centura Banks before its sale to RBC Financial Group in 2001. Red Hat passes $1 billion in annual revenue, 100 Raleigh jobs coming. And this article, this snippet of an article, also has a picture along with it on top, a picture of a man wearing a suit and tie. The caption reads, Jim Whitehurst is the CEO at Raleigh-based Red Hat. Red Hat is officially a billion-dollar company. The Raleigh-based software firm on Wednesday reported that total revenue for fiscal year 2012 was $1.13 billion, a 25% increase over the previous year, making Red Hat the first open-source software company to achieve the milestone, CEO Jim Whitehurst said. The company also unveiled a $300 million share repurchase plan that will replace its existing repurchase plan that expired March 30th. For the quarter, Red Hat's net income clocked in at $146 million. The company ended the fiscal year with 4,560 employees, 800 employees more than last year. CFO Charlie Peters said the company expects to hire 100 additional employees in this calendar year. And we're going to stop there as we're running out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. Our phone number, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.